Good morning. It's nice to see you here. I know that there are several other events happening today, and that may account for the small paucity of attendance, but I see some other people visiting or who haven't been here for a while who are making up the difference. Scripture readings today start with the book of Numbers, chapter 29. Now, in the first month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. It will be to you a day for blowing trumpets. Then, on the tenth day of this seventh month, you shall have another holy convocation. You shall humble yourselves. You shall not do any work. A verse from Deuteronomy. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. And next from the New Testament, a reading from the book of Romans. Paul is writing to Christians generally. But if some of the Hebrew branches were broken off, and you, being a savage Gentile olive branch, was grafted in among the Hebrews and became partakers with them of the rich root of the Hebrew olive tree. Therefore, do not be arrogant toward the Hebrew branches. But if you are arrogant, remember that it is not you who supports the root, but rather the root that supports you. Now you may say, Hebrew branches were broken off so that I may be grafted in. Quite right, they were broken off for their unbelief. But you stand solely on your faith. Do not be conceited, but instead fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you if your faith falters. Behold then the kindness and severity of God. To those who fall comes severity, but to you has come God's kindness, provided you manifest his kindness. Otherwise, you also will be cut off. And the Jews as well, if they do recover their belief, they will be restored, for God is able to graft them in again. Finally, a reading from the Gospels, the book of Matthew, chapter 21. Jesus is speaking to the chief priests in the Jerusalem temple. He said, "But what do you think? A man had two sons, and he came to the first and said, 'Son, go work today in the vineyards.' And he answered, 'I will not.' But afterwards he repented and obeyed. The man came to the second son and said the same thing. This son answered, 'I will go, sir.' But he did not go. Which of these two did the will of their father?" The children can leave at this point. Thank you. I had planned to continue my exploration of the roots of Quakerism in the Reformation and in the Puritan culture that swept across England roughly 400 years ago. I hope to return to that topic later this month. However, this week I received an inspiration to talk instead about the season of the year that we are entering and to explore the relationship between Christians and Jews, which Paul writes about in the scripture passage we have just read. For the past 8 months, the Bible class has been studying a book about Paul on Tuesday evenings, and this provides some of the ideas I will elaborate upon here. It is not too late to join us in that class. However, before we turn to Paul, I want to point out something you probably won't hear about on the television or the internet. We are in the final hours of the Jewish year 5778. The new year 5779 will begin today at sundown. It will be marked not by drunken revelry and popping firecrackers, but by lighting of candles, prayers, sermons, and confessions of sins. These sober rituals will resume tomorrow and the next day, and they will culminate 10 days from now with another full day of prayer and confession accentuated by a day-long fast, while wearing clothes that remind people of their mortality. This may strike you as a peculiar way to observe a new year, and it may arouse your curiosity if you are not already familiar with these customs. The Jewish New Year commemorates the creation of the world as recounted in the first chapter of Genesis, but that section of the Bible is not read in synagogues during the New Year. Instead, the passage of the Bible read on New Year's Day is the casting out of Hagar and her son Ishmael, as recounted in the 21st chapter of Genesis. That story ties in quite well with Paul's warning in the passage we just read from Romans, to the effect that we adhere to the covenant through grace and that no one is secure in their relationship with God through their own strength, virtue, or social status. Therefore, humility and fear should replace entitlement and arrogance, whether one is a Christian or a Jew. This same theme is emphasized by the sober tenor of the Jewish rituals for the New Year. Hence, the New Year is a time of rededication to the covenant and to the demands of the covenant, rather than a lighthearted celebration of creation and human existence. The creation itself may be deemed very good, but the role of humans in creation is ever problematic. In these ways and more, the Jewish New Year illustrates the contrarian tendencies of the Jewish outlook and tradition. A band of slaves that left Egypt over 3,000 years ago to create an independent society turned the world on its head, especially so when the Hebrew Bible became a key religious text for the Roman Empire and for European culture over 1,700 years ago, with the Edict of Milan in 313. I doubt that Constantine knew what he was doing at that moment, but nevertheless, here we are today reading the Torah rather than the Aeneid. Anyone who needs to find a miracle can meditate upon this highly improbable fact. Given the contrarian Jewish spirit, it should not surprise us that many Jewish customs appear to be adopted simply to show that Jews can be different. Here are some examples. The day does not need to begin with sunrise. It can begin with sunset. The year does not necessarily begin with spring equinox or with winter solstice. It can begin in the autumn. The year does not have to start in the first month. It can begin in the seventh month. Conversely, the first month of the year does not have to be numbered the first month. It could be the seventh month. The new year can be celebrated with fasting rather than festivity. The color of death and mourning does not have to be black. It can be white. Writing does not have to go from left to right. It can go from right to left. Grace for food does not have to precede a meal. It can follow a meal. As the reading from Deuteronomy said, "You shall eat, be satisfied, and then bless the Lord." Hence, the Jewish custom is to give a short blessing before a meal and a much longer blessing afterwards. The eldest son does not have to inherit the family fortune. It could be the second son. And as the last chapter of Numbers points out, daughters are also included in the family fortune. And nothing in the New Testament makes an equivalent claim to that precedent. The cumulative effect of these counterintuitive Jewish customs is disorienting. In the words of the Gospel, the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Life does not have to be logical. Nonconformity is a blessing, and often a sign of God's favor. However, for conventional people, this contrarian habit can produce intense dislike of Jews. Aristocracies, in particular, like predictable customs and obedient citizens, and Jews are often seen as rabble-rousers and misfits. Not surprising, therefore, that aristocrats often malign the Jews and blame them for all sorts of problems that have nothing to do with Jews. Nonconformity is something that Quakers as well can identify with. Hence, we might find some common interest with Jewish efforts to reconstruct consensual reality Like the Jews, Quakers have accepted the role of a peculiar people with sober habits and somber dress, who strive to keep apart from the world's people. The Jewish Sabbath is a practice of structured inactivity. So is Quaker worship. This is not to say, however, that Quakers have often recognized these similarities. Like Jews, Quakers have reinvented themselves several times over the past 370 years in response to shifting cultural patterns. Initially charismatic, Quakers hunkered down under persecution, then emerged as quietists, then as evangelicals, later as Holiness Methodists. Then in the 20th century, some Quakers became secular or universalist. Like Jews, Quakers also were blamed for many of the problems of the interregnum under the protectorate of Cromwell. Because Jews have been masters of nonconformity, Jewish culture has also reinvented itself repeatedly throughout history. The ragtag band of Hebrew slaves led by Moses through the desert becomes an organized military force under the leadership of Joshua, who takes the Hebrews into the Promised Land. However, I should add that the archaeological record appears to dispute any actual military invasion of Palestine in that era. After the Hebrews were settled in the Promised Land, there is a period of relative anarchy, when everyone was free to do what they pleased. Apparently, this period of anarchy unravels, and the prophet Samuel initiates the imperial phase of Judaism under King Saul and King David. Later, under the reign of King Josiah, priests discover a new book by Moses, centuries after Moses had died. And Josiah, acting under the authority of that book, Deuteronomy, Josiah persecutes Jews who honor the Queen of Heaven as God's consort. The prophet Jeremiah continues the attack on the Queen of Heaven and promotes a strict Jewish monotheism. The imperial phase of Judaism ends with the invasion of Assyria and Babylon, and Jews are forced into captivity, and many adapted very well. Like the Quakers in Philadelphia, they stayed to do well in Babylon. Never satisfied, however, Ezra and Nehemiah lead a resettlement effort and build the second temple in Jerusalem. However, more Jews stay in Babylon than follow Ezra to Jerusalem. The second temple period ends with the Roman invasion to quash a civil war between Jews in Jerusalem. There are still more Jewish rebellions, culminating in 132 AD with the Bar Kokhba rebellion. And then Jews abandoned militarism for nearly 1800 years. And the rabbinic phase of Judaism begins in earnest. That phase continues today, but innovations continue. Jewish nonconformity generated many Jewish sects, often with violent conflicts between them, and conflicts with non-Jewish pagan authorities. Here is a very short list. Even while Moses led the Israelites, there were several rebellions recorded in the Bible. The Maccabees revolted against Greek rulers, but also ignited a civil war in Jerusalem. Under the Roman rule, several Jewish factions fought with one another. One of these factions were Christian Jews who had encountered Jesus as a resurrected Messiah. Other factions were rabbis who predicted a general resurrection. The rabbis and the Christians were the two leading Jewish factions that survived the series of rebellions following the destruction of the Second Temple by Rome. Most other Jewish factions simply disappeared. Paul is writing in the early 6th century of the 6th decade of the 1st century, roughly from 51 to 54 AD. This is about a decade before Jerusalem degenerates into civil war once again. Paul sets about to rethink Jewish theology and practice based upon the revelation that Jesus is the Messiah. In so doing, he turns the Jewish religion on its head. But that is exactly the nature of the Jewish religion. It is always reinventing itself. So in a sense, Paul is doing what Jews have done time and time again. Moreover, the rabbis would also reinvent Judaism at about the same time that Christianity is taking place. And their version of Judaism is a dramatic revision of Second Temple Judaism. There are, in fact, several parallels between Rabbinic Judaism and early Christianity. Both groups anticipate a general resurrection of the dead. Both groups renounce animal sacrifice. Both groups promote prayer. Both groups go a long way toward renouncing violence. This is more explicit among the Christians, but it is more carefully observed among the Jews. Three revolts and a thorough trouncing by Rome left the rabbis of the second century leery of further military exploits. As minority members of European, Middle Eastern, and North African society for the next 1800 years, Jews nearly become pacifists, meekly accepting whatever restrictions the dominant society imposes upon them for living space and livelihood. Not until the rise of Zionism in the 19th century do Jews consider another claim to statehood and military power. And not until 1948 does militarism become the dominant Jewish strategy. Even today, there are many Jews who reject the allure of Zionism. The situation is very nearly the reverse for Christians. Starting out as a tiny persecuted minority, led by a charismatic but nonviolent leader and his ragged band of apostles, Christianity slowly spreads for almost 300 years with no aspirations to power or militarism. When it is embraced by Constantine in the year 313, Christianity merges with the Roman Empire and it succumbs to the allure of political and military power. Only a tiny minority of monks, lay Franciscans, Catholic workers, Anabaptists, and Quakers will, in the distant future, return to the original gospel of the Prince of Peace. Long before Christianity is absorbed by the Roman Empire, however, Paul maintains that only those Jews who acknowledge the resurrection of Jesus and his role as the Messiah are included in the Abrahamic covenant. All the rest have been cast aside. Paul expects Jesus to return to Jerusalem in glory to set the record straight. Now, almost 2,000 years later, there is much that we can attribute to the influence of Jesus in the world. Yet no Messiah has appeared in visible glory. It would appear that Paul was mistaken on this central claim, and if so, this calls into question some of his other claims. Moreover, Paul does not foresee a time when Christians are no longer a persecuted minority, but will actually constitute the nominal majority of the Roman Empire. But at that point, what does faith in the risen Lord require of Christians when there is no price to pay for it? Is this the same faith that Paul writes about? As William Penn said, when there is no cross, there is no crown. When we consider the parable of the two sons, which we just read, we may have to consider that the Jews, who have renounced violence on the whole with more fidelity than Christians have done, may be entitled to a more favorable judgment. For most of the past 2,000 years, Jews have relinquished personal power and prestige in order to preserve a religious legacy. Perhaps Jesus will favor these Jews over Christians if he actually does return with visible power to judge the world. Once again, we should approach the question of salvation with fear and trembling rather than certainty. In the meantime, we have to consider how Jews and Christians can cooperate today despite making conflicting claims about Jesus of Nazareth. I believe the place to begin is with humility, recognizing, as Paul reminds us, that whatever favor that Christians have enjoyed from God is based on the terms of the Abrahamic covenant. Hence, it is not our strength or virtue that determines God's grace, but rather God's grace that includes us. And that inclusion may depend upon our willingness to manifest God's impartial kindness. There are several other reasons for Christians to be humble in the company of Jews. We should recognize that Christians have fallen far short of the gospel which we proclaim, and at times Christians have actively misused and misrepresented the gospel to obtain worldly power, prestige, security, wealth, empires, and privilege. Christians have enslaved non-Christians with the blessing of the Pope. Before Columbus discovered the New World, the Pope encouraged Christians to enslave, dispossess, and eradicate non-Christians who would not convert. This became the basis of colonial policy for the next several centuries and is incorporated into American federal law today. Christians have often waged war against other Christians. Christians have often subordinated Christian allegiance to national allegiance. White Christians have frequently refused to recognize the full humanity of non-white Christians, even in the same nation. European Christians and many American Christians have reviled and rejected Jews, and at times Christians have assaulted and organized mob violence against Jewish neighbors. At times, entire nations have sought to eradicate Jewish inhabitants. This Christian animosity is the basis of Zionism, because many Jews no longer believe that they can be safe in a Christian country. As much as we may decry the plight of Palestinians under Zionism, very few Christians acknowledge the role that Christianity has played in this tragedy due to centuries of Jewish persecution that produced Zionism. Quakers have not, by and large, been at the forefront of these sins and failings. Even so, we, and I certainly include myself in this judgment, we have often been too weary or preoccupied or simply reconciled to the sins of the world to object to the worst of these sins and crimes. In this regard, there are things we could learn from our Jewish neighbors, many of whom practice the adage, if you see something, say something. Jewish chutzpah, or pushiness, is often abrasive, but it requires the same devotion and energy that motivated early Quakers to address kings and sultans, judges and juries with prophetic confidence. If we want to regain some of the vigor of those early Quaker days, we could do well by visiting our Jewish neighbors to see how they do it today. What better time to begin than on the new year of 5779?